Hello and welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm Laura Zaro Kopinski. On our first show, I'm thrilled to share an interview with author Anne Boyd Rue. Her newest book, Meg Jo Beth Amy, The Story of Little Women and Why It Still Matters, comes out on Tuesday, August 21st. This is a must-read for all of the devoted Alcott fans out there. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
It's really great timing with the 150th anniversary of the publication. Talk about the book's relevance today, and I was curious what inspired you to take Meg Jo Beth Amy on as your next project, if that had to do with the anniversary coming up, or I'm assuming you had to start the book much earlier.
Right, yeah. Well, that wasn't the initial reason, but that gave me the impetus to get started on it and to, you know, finish it as quickly as I could. But I've always loved books about books. I've been, I reviewed some and I've read some that I really liked. Michael Gora has a great book about the portrait of a lady, Henry James's novel called The Portrait of a Novel that I just loved. And Rebecca Mead wrote one on Middlemarch called My Life in Middlemarch. And hers is a bit more of, you know, it's kind of got a lot of memoir in it, but they're different styles of books about books. And I've just been really fascinated with them and thought, what a great way to write about literature for a wider audience outside of academia, which I have become very interested in doing. And my last book was a biography of a little known woman writer, Constance Fenimore Wilson, who was a friend of Henry James, but, you know, was as well known in her lifetime as he was. But she's been forgotten, and that was written for Norton for a trade audience. So that was kind of my shift into writing for a wider audience, and I wanted to keep doing that. And then I was thinking one night about, you know, what book would I ever write about that people would be interested enough in, you know, because I do a lot of work on little-known women writers, and I thought about Little Women immediately because I had written about Alcott in my first book, and which is my dissertation, and I had always loved Little Women, and I should say I loved it since graduate school. I can tell you about my story of reading Little Women, but I, you know, named my daughter, gave her the middle name Josephine, and so I thought, well, Little Women would be really exciting to write about. Let me just think about that. And the next day when I got up, I just Googled it to see, you know, when exactly was it published, and saw 1868. This was in 2015, and I was still finishing up my Wilson biography. So I had, you know, when I saw that the anniversary was coming in 3 years and, you know, and kind of knew what the production timeline was like. I mean, you have to have a book done into your editor a year before the book comes out.
Right.
So she'll edit it and you'll make some changes and things, but it really needs to be solid. You know, you can't be completely rewriting it or something. Because you have to turn around the revisions quickly, and then they do copy editing, and then, you know, that takes a while, and then there's all the promotional, you know, build up. I mean, it really takes, it's kind of amazing in this day and age. So I was able to get a grant and take a year off from teaching to write the book, and it just happened really fast. It's because I guess this anniversary was coming up.
So much interest, for sure. I mean, it couldn't be better timing when everyone's so eager to get more and more things Alcott.
Right. And of course, it was long after I'd started the book that I heard about the BBC masterpiece production. And actually, I had known most of the time I was writing the book that there was a script that Sony was supposed to be working on. And there was a different writer before, I can't remember her name, and then I heard Greta Gerwig had taken it over, and then she became super famous with Lady Bird, and still, you know, I had the Google alert set up for Greta Gerwig, Little Women, to see, like, and then it was just like a month or so ago that we heard, yes, it's happening. And
yeah, I didn't realize that until you had said it at Summer Conversations at that opening panel, and then I was very excited when I looked it all up. I think that's going to be really well done.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. I just can't wait to see what she does with it, because we need a new Little Women, you know, a big production like that for the next generation. because it, you know, unfortunately, Little Women is not read as much by young readers as it used to be. And, you know, even though it regularly ranks on these lists of favorite novels, like the PBS Great American Reads that they're doing now, it's one of the 100 favorite novels of Americans. And, you know, but it's, if it's going to be around for another 150 years, we need to make sure young people are still reading it and they're not encountering it in schools. You know, so we, you know, we can't count on the schools to keep it alive, like a book like Huck Finn. I mean, Huck Finn would not be alive if they weren't reading it in schools, right? But Little Women is a book that's been passed down from, you know, passed down within families and, you know, generationally has kind of been my sense of things.
Which and is so interesting when you were talking in the book about Huck Finn. I mean, I'm a school librarian, so I totally see that even in myself and who I've recommended the book to. You know, I think it really struck me in terms of, you know, I try to think really carefully about recommending kids books that offer windows into a whole variety of experiences in terms of culture and religion and ability and everything. But we do sort of overlook having boys see the world through a girl protagonist's eyes. And I thought that was such an interesting part. It really inspired me to try to
pitch
it to more boys. Well, it just, I think it is really important. And I think the hard thing is how title is so hard to get them past. How would you pitch it to a young male reader?
Yeah, the title does create a big hurdle, unfortunately. But like, what if it had been called something like The March Family instead? Be totally easier to sell. Part of the problem is that there's so much shame attached to anything female, you know, for boys. So much shame in our culture. You know, how, as, you know, as a librarian or teacher, can you overcome that? Right? I mean, that's a huge thing. And so for a boy to walk around with a book called Little Women takes guts, right? But I discovered that I introduced the book to a couple of sixth grade English classes at my daughter's school and encouraged them to choose it for their independent reading that they do. Like every quarter they pick a new book, and this is like in little groups, kind of a book club thing. And we talked about, you know, is this a book for girls or, you know, just for girls? And they all said, no, you know, it's not. I mean, they just read Tom Sawyer. So it's perfect to introduce them to Little Women and say, look, this is a book, you know, about girls of the same time period. It's just looking at things from a little different point of view. Wouldn't that be cool? And when it came time for them to pick their books, I think four groups chose Little Women. And one of the groups was all boys. And I met with them and talked with them, and they were great. They had interesting thoughts about the book and the girls and about Lori. They were interested in Lori too. And then, so I guess, you know, in that sense, I did successfully pitch it, right? Because I pitched it in the context of, you know, what else are you reading and why not read this too? You know, because a lot of kids are reading Tom Sawyer in schools and the middle grade level. And I think sixth grade is maybe a good time. Is my sense of things. I mean, my daughter's now going into high school, and I've watched as things have kind of, you know, gotten a little more intense, you know, from seventh and eighth grade. I don't know if I approach those same boys now if they would read it, but they were open in sixth grade. And if you get them when they're younger like that, then maybe they'll be more open later on to pick up another book about a girl. And the other thing I would tell younger readers, you don't have to read the whole thing. It is two books in one, and the first book is plenty to tackle, you know, and maybe also, you know, explaining to them that it's a book not just about four girls growing up, but about their neighbor, Lori, who really is a boy despite his name.
Yeah. And I think just having those conversations and getting them to think about it. And
well, and, I mean,
we don't think anything about the opposite. So
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you know, you know, maybe kind of, you know, presenting it to them that way. You know, you see all these girls in your classes reading Tom Sawyer or these books about boys. The Outsiders was another book there, The Giver, you know.
And Harry Potter. The main protagonist is a boy.
Right. And it's really interesting that when the book, I don't think I mentioned this when you were there, but when the book was first published, it was not read only by girls. Mm-hmm. It was read by everybody, boys, girls, men, women, grandparents, you know, I mean, it became such a popular book, though, even though it was, you know, kind of aimed at girls, its popularity, you know, bled over into other groups, and there was no shame attached to it, you know, for men to read it. It was just a good book, you know, mm-hmm. so why wouldn't they want to read it? And lots of men, George Orwell read the book, Theodore Roosevelt loved the book. You can also tell them that the YA author John Green loved Little Women.
Oh, that's a good hook as well.
That's a good hook, isn't it? Because there's this interview online you can find in, like, I think it's the Sydney Herald, you know, it's in an Australian newspaper, where he mentions Little Women as one of the books he loved when he was young, and he didn't understand why it was a book only for girls. So that, you know, that gives me some hope. And I think we really need to kind of, yeah, just break down this sort of larger assumption that boys won't and can't read girls' books, because mm-hmm. I think that's inhibiting them and us in a lot of ways.
The adults really thinking about that.
Right.
One thing I was thinking a lot about when I was reading it, because I've read a lot of different Alcott biographies, mm-hmm. but I'm curious if you think the reader's knowledge that these characters, Joe, Meg, Beth, and Amy, are the real Louisa, Anna, Lizzie, May, how much that has impacted the novel's popularity, that rooting in reality but sort of merged with fiction.
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure how many readers, especially young readers, know that when they first read the book, but I don't think they're surprised when they find it out, because the girls are so real. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just are so distinctive. Their voices just pop out on the very first page. I mean, you can just hear them all talking and squabbling with each other. And you get a clear sense on page one of the four different girls' individual personalities. I mean, that's hard as a writer to do, and she just nailed it. I think that's really one of the keys to its enduring popularity, is that the four girls are so distinctive. They're just individuals. That's something that you didn't see a lot in literature of that period, and you didn't see it for much of the 20th century, I would say. Girls mm-hmm. who were individuals, you know, like that. So, I mean, girls were often, female characters, I should say, were very often types, right? And they were mm-hmm. meant to sort of illustrate the virtues and vices of their sex. They were not allowed to be flawed, unique individuals. But that's what Alcott did right there on the page. And it's because, you know, a good part of the reason is because they were based on her own sisters. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that helps make them so real.
Right.
I think the other, when I was reading it again this year, I have a toddler, so sort of looking at it through that new mother perspective. At Marm, could you talk about that a little bit, just her portrayal and that relevance today?
Well, I think knowing the story of Abigail Alcott, you know, behind the woman behind Marmee, helps us understand her better and notice mm-hmm. things about her that maybe we wouldn't notice on a first read. In some ways, she seems so perfect and idealized, but there are cracks in her facade that I think are really interesting. And she, you know, for instance, I think one of the most important lines to me in the book is when she tells Joe, you know, Joe's struggling with her temper, right? Because she has been so angry at Amy, she let her fall through the ice, and she's really scared, you know, about where her temper leads her. And she tells Marmee, "You don't know anything about it." And Marmee's like, "Oh no, I do." She said, "I'm angry every day of my life, but I've learned not to show it." But she still feels it, mm-hmm. and that was a huge admission in 1868. I mean, we probably would like it if she showed it periodically too.
But
what she's admitting to Joe is that I'm not perfect. I'm not the perfect person, mm-hmm. and that gives Joe hope that she can learn to master her own temper too. You know, and I think that's important, that Marmee isn't simply sitting on high, you know, sort of handing down these moral pronouncements, girls, this is how you should be, and, you know, giving them a hard time when they're not good, which is, you know, what adults did in fiction up until that time, you know, definitely,
right.
Well after. Instead, she sits back and empathizes with them and says, "I know it's hard."
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, let's see what happens if we don't all help out and pitch in around the house, for instance. The experiments chapter is one of my favorites.
Totally agree.
I just chuckle so hard when I read that, because I think that's what I need to do sometimes, is just take a day off from doing anything around the house and see how everybody else likes it, right?
Yep.
Right, because everything falls apart without her. Mm-hmm. And the girls don't realize all of the invisible labor that she performs for them. And, you know, and not only that, but they realize that, you know, that the things run so much more smoothly if everybody helps out. So it doesn't have to be all on Marmee's shoulders. And that, to me, I mean, she conveys that subtly throughout. And she also tells that to Meg after Meg has her children and she's trying to be the perfect mother. And it, to me, that is such an important message that women still need, right? We still need to know that we don't have to do it all, that we don't have to be perfect, because we're constantly made to feel that we should be perfect as
such
mothers.
It's such a interesting character to revisit and pick up on those things you wouldn't ordinarily or necessarily pick up on as a child. And I think that's one of the things I love so much about the book. You know, you read it one time and pick up on certain things and relate to different characters, and you read it a different time and pick up on other things.
Right. It's in some ways it's an epic book. I mean, it looks at these four girls growing up, but there's so much going on. There's so many characters who are growing and developing, and what it's really about life, you know. Mm-hmm. And you can't get more epic than that, right? So it's, you know, right. And so as we read it at different points, we notice different things and we relate to. By the time Louisa May Alcott wrote that book, she really understood a lot about life, not only through her own experiences as a young woman, but you know, because of her close bond to her mother and the trials that her mother had endured. And then also, you know, watching her older sister Anna get married and have children, she really understood a lot. And it's one of those books that you can just keep reading over and over again.
Well, your book got me thinking about, just in terms of that, I love the parts where you were talking about how women have had such strong and sort of divided reactions to her marrying Joe to Professor Bear, and how you quoted that line that about her saying, "I haven't given up the hope that I may write a good book yet, but I can wait, and I'm sure it'll be better for such experiences." And I thought that was so interesting, and how in a way, you know, I think I remember feeling this way a little bit as like a teenager, you know, why isn't she just, you know, choosing her writing? But really, it's pretty progressive for the time for her to be trying to do both.
Right. It's still for our time, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and so many women writers today are still struggling with this, you know, trying to navigate being both a writer and a mother, and, you know, or any of us who have careers. You know, it's a real struggle. And in some ways, you know, our time is really the first time, I think, that women have embraced both, allowed themselves to embrace both on such a mass scale. And it's in some ways, it's a huge experiment still. And Alcott, she basically is saying, you know, Joe can do it all, but maybe not all at the same time, right? Mm-hmm. She gives Joe time off to, you know, be with her family, and then she becomes a writer actually in the third volume of the book once her children are grown. Mm-hmm. She didn't really, and I write about this at length. I wrote about it at length actually in my first book, about how women writers of the time, those who were really wanted to devote themselves to career the way Louisa herself did, didn't think they could get married to. There was just no way, right? You're serving two masters. There's two, these are two separate lives. You can't live both. And those who tried, you know, really suffered for it. And the tragic example of it, you know, not necessarily that this is why, you know, but the very tragic story of her sister, May, the youngest daughter, who's Amy in the book, you know, May went on to become a very successful artist in Europe after Louisa's book sold so well, and she became famous and rich. She had all this money to take, you know, May to Europe and let her do art lessons over there. And May ended up moving to France and married a man and had a child. And Louisa was just astounded because at the same time she's saying, I'm going to be this artist too. She's going to do it all. Mm-hmm. And Louisa was fascinated with this experiment and started writing a novel about it. It's called Diana in Persis, and sadly she never finished it because when May died after giving birth to her child, she was so upset, right? Just so, you know, devastated and grieving her sister, but also I think grieving the loss of that idea that mm-hmm. maybe she could do it all. And it's sad that May didn't really get a chance to, you know, to try to do that. But Louise was exploring that in her fiction. She was very interested in that idea. And when she wrote Little Women in 1868, she couldn't quite conceive of that yet. Mm-hmm. And I think as, you know, feminist critics, you know, and I consider myself a feminist critic, have been kind of hard on Little Women in the past, you know, for the fact that Jo made the choice that she did. You know, Louisa wanted her to stay a literary spinster like herself. Mm-hmm. Those are her words, literary spinster. but she felt pressured to marry her off. So I think the choice that she makes in Professor Bear has also been pretty contentious because in some ways she, you know, she's marrying an older man. He's a professor. But I see them as really having a very egalitarian relationship. I mean, she tells him when she accepts his marriage proposal, you know, I'm going to help earn the money to support us. And you better get used to that idea or this isn't going to work. Mm-hmm. That's a paraphrase, but that's basically what she says. And I mean, that's kind of astonishing, you know, mm-hmm. and she never gets any credit for that.
Well, and they cut that out of, I think you mentioned this at the talk, how they, or maybe in the book, how they cut that out of a lot of the movie scenes and things.
It's an important piece. It hasn't been in any of the movies. I don't remember if it was in the BBC adaptation. I don't think it was, or I would have really remembered that. But it's possible it was in there, and I haven't watched it again, so I need to rewatch it. But I hope it's in the Greta Gerwig film.
I bet it will be.
Right, I bet it will be.
I would just say last, I don't want to take too much of your time, but the other thing I just thought was fascinating, you were talking about that phenomenon about how it seems like practically every American woman writer, not every, but very many, you know, trace their ambition back to Jo. And I just was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that phenomenon, because I really didn't realize until reading the book just how many it is.
Oh, I didn't realize either. I had no idea when I started writing this book. That was one of the biggest surprises to me, and just astonished me, was that, because, you know, I wanted to have some quotes from writers who've been inspired by her, and they just kept coming in. And they're still coming. Yeah, I still get, you know, people send me, oh, did you see Tracy K. Smith, the poet laureate, is just said in the New York Times that she loved Little Women. I'm like, what? It's just like everywhere.
It's everywhere.
So it was such an influential book for so many women writers of all different kinds of backgrounds for so many years, because there just weren't many options available. There weren't many characters like Jo in literature that really devoted themselves to writing in this way. And what I think is so exceptional about Jo is that she's not conflicted about it. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, her family supports her. She doesn't feel, you know, like she has to hide it. She's not embarrassed because she's a woman. I mean, there's a little bit of, you know, that maybe when she goes to the publisher's office and she doesn't want it to be published under her own name, but that's kind of because she's writing sensation fiction and she doesn't want her family to know about it. That's not so much about gender. The anxiety that so many women writers felt about treading on this male preserve of authorship, Jo doesn't have it, and Alcott didn't really have it either. And it's probably the most remarkable thing about her, because every other woman writer that I've encountered from the 19th century had it in spades.
Interesting.
In spades. I mean, Constance Fenimore Wilson was, it ruled her life, I think. You know, I mean, it really impacted her so much as a writer. And so, you know, how wonderful for girls to grow up with this model of a, you know, of a young woman who's celebrated for her writing, mm-hmm. who's told by her sister, you know, you're a Shakespeare. I mean, that's incredible.
It is incredible.
It really is. And because there were so many other highly negative portrayals of women writers, of girls wanting to write, you know, that came out throughout the 19th century. And it's wonderful that Jo March is the one who really lived in our imaginations and inspired so many women writers. I couldn't believe, I mean, I had to basically just include a page-long footnote in the back with all of them. So many.
It's incredible. Well, I think that's a really interesting point. It's not just that she did it. It was how she did it and her mentality. And now we can sort of, in a way, once you've read it, sort of think to yourself, well, Jo did it, why can't I? And
exactly.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think there are a lot of Alcott fans who are going to be very excited. It was just such a joy to read. And I love the option you have. Speaking of book clubs, I think you're going to get some very excited book clubs talking to you as well.
Oh, yeah, right. And that's probably something I'll extend even to after, you know, the pre-order period has ended, because mm-hmm. I would enjoy that. That would be fun.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to get more people to read it so I can talk about it with more people. So,
right. You know, it's so funny that the person who won the book from your giveaway.
Oh yeah.
I actually know her.
Oh really?
I don't know. Yeah. In fact, she's in my acknowledgments. It's such a weird coincidence.
Oh, that's so exciting.
Yeah, she was part of this group of women writers here in New Orleans that from the Women's National Book Association. They wanted to read Little Women with me and talk to me about it while I was writing my book, and it was so helpful and really, really wonderful. So I know she said she just finished reading it last night, and so it was fun.
Oh, that's great.
Well, she was able to get a copy already.
Yeah, well, when I went to Orchard House, I was like, oh, this is such a privilege that I live near Concord and I can get it already. So I figured put some good Little Women karma out there.
Oh, no, I really appreciate that, yeah, because now she's spreading the word to people. So that's awesome. Thank you.
Great. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for talking to me.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for, you know, your interest in the book and wanting to share it with your readers. I think that's awesome. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. This is such a treat. So I appreciate you talking with me.
Meg Jo, Beth Amy, The Story of Little Women and Why It Still Matters comes out on Tuesday, August 21st. So get your library holds ready or go visit your local bookstore. Also be sure to check out Anne's website, anneboydrew.com, for some exciting pre-order giveaways, including a virtual visit from Anne for your book club. You can also follow Anne on Twitter at @AnneBoydRue. And for more book recommendations and ideas for creating a culture of reading in your home, you can visit my site, abookishhome.com, and follow me on Twitter @abookishhome. Happy reading!